calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome to our program. A lot going on. This whole issue of whether Iran is somehow supplying Iraq with weapons that just seem to be, well, not seem to be, that are labeled in English, which would suggest that actually if they were manufactured in Iran, they were manufactured for the international weapons trade. No, still no discussion in the mainstream media. We brought this up yesterday of Saudi Arabia holding fundraisers to send money to the Sunni insurgents, the ones who are responsible for the vast majority of American deaths in Iraq. But Iran getting a lot of attention, and Newsweek reporting now a third carrier group on its way. So we will see how this all shakes out. Democratic House leaders circulated a non-binding resolution yesterday. This is incredible. This is incredible. The people of the United States, I mean, at the top of the USA Today today, 63%, I believe it was, of Americans say all of American troops should be out of Iraq by the end of next year. Now, in order to do that, you'd have to start withdrawing right now. In order to do it right, you know, and do it in an organized and straightforward fashion. And yet the Democratic leaders in the House are circulating a non-binding resolution. In other words, not a law, just something that says, we disapprove of the decision of President George W. Bush to deploy more than 20,000 additional United States combat troops in Iraq. It's like, we don't like your surge, sir, please. May we please speak, sir, and tell you we don't like your surge? No, you may not. Oh, okay, we'll be quiet. I mean, that's what happened in the Senate. The Republicans, you know, John Warner, the guy who put the thing forward, ended up voting against it. So anyway, we have that. But there's a couple of pieces of news that are going to affect all of our lives, that are affecting on an ongoing basis all of our lives in a very, very, very big way that I'm concerned are just going to completely slip by the radar, and that I doubt pretty much anybody else is going to be talking about today, and because it's not the sexy war stuff, but it is the sexy, you know, are you going to have a job in the future? Are your kids going to have a job in the future? What kind of job is that going to be? Is there going to be a middle class left in America? Who really runs this country? What's the oligarchy all about? Who's in power? What's in control? Who's in control? All this kind of stuff. And there are, what I want to share with you are little bits and pieces, fragments, as it were, from two stories in today's New York Times and one in the Wall Street Journal. And pull what may seem to be three completely different things together for you in a way that all of a sudden it's like, ah, the forehead slap. Yeah, now I get it. Let me just share the headlines with you first. EU signals tougher standards on tariffs. This is from the Wall Street Journal. And then these two from the New York Times. U.S. trade deficit grew to another record in 06, and SEC seeks to curtail investor suits. Investor lawsuits? The SEC is trying to stop, it's trying to cut back on investor lawsuits. Why would that be happening? Why? And what's bringing it about? And what does that have to do with you or me? You know, the vast majority of people do not have, basically, you know, maybe they got a few $100 or a few $1,000 in stock in an IRA or 401k or something, but you know, there's only a very small number of people, a very small percentage of people in the United States. You know, within the top, you know, probably 5% at the most, arguably the top 2%, who derive most of their income from stocks. And who are really active in the whole investor community, who might even want to sue a company for malfeasance. So why is this a big deal? Well, let me tell you, it is a big deal because it has to do with who runs this country and how it's all shaking out. What has happened here, in fact, I'm going to start here. This is Stephen Labaton in today's New York Times. Actually, he's yesterday's New York Times. No, today's. Today's February 13th. How is it that I have an article here in tomorrow's New York Times, the 14th? I guess it must be for tomorrow's paper. Anyhow, yeah, today is the 13th. In fact, today, I guess today is the day that Mercury goes retrograde, for those of you who are paying attention. Good luck to all of us, right? For the next 5 weeks, until March 7th. Anyhow, the Securities and Exchange Commission, this is from today's paper, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, this is the government agency that regulates corporations, basically, particularly as it has to do with their ability to buy and sell stock and function in the marketplace. The SEC has begun to take steps on two fronts to protect corporations, executives, and accounting firms from investor lawsuits that accuse them of fraud. Now, the libertarian slash conservative slash Republican argument has always been, oh, well, you know, it's the, you don't need democracy, you have capitalism, and the free market is going to solve everything, and really the only kind of laws you should have are the laws against fraud, and now we're going to do away with those? Well, first of all, it's a weak argument. But secondly, this demonstrates that in the face of unrestrained corporate power, they're going to do away with those laws as well. Last Friday, the commission filed, this is from the New York Times, the commission filed a little-known noticed brief in the Supreme Court urging the adoption of a legal standard that would make it harder for shareholders to prevail in fraud lawsuits against publicly traded companies and their executives. At the same time, the agency's chief accountant, this is the Securities and Exchange Commission, the agency's chief accountant told a conference that it, the SEC, was considering ways to protect accounting firms from large damage awards in cases brought by investors and companies. In other words, we want to make sure that people who do what Enron did don't get prosecuted too badly for it, and that investors who get screwed, like investors in Enron got screwed, don't have too much recourse. We don't want people to necessarily be able to get their nest egg back. After all, it might cause a loss of profit for the accounting company. It might be kind of tough on the corporation that committed the fraud. We can't have that. And then we get to the core of it, to the nub of it. And this is how this ties into our international trade deficit and this whole thing about the European Union and tariffs. And this is just fascinating. You get to the core of it, and they point out in this New York Times article that the commission's chief accountant, this is the guy who's the head CPA at the SEC, right? The top bookkeeper at the agency that oversees bookkeepers. His name is Conrad Hewitt. And he's talking to a bunch of lawyers, securities lawyers, presumably most of whom defend corporations and accounting firms against lawsuits from people like you or me, if we were, you know, small investors in Enron or something like that, you know, people who have their, you know, 401ks in their companies or whatever, or even, frankly, even the large investors. But there's not that many of them. Anyhow, he's talking to this group of security lawyers, and he says that because there are only four large accounting firms that still exist, we're down to four, the agency has begun to consider how to limit the liability of those firms in suits brought by investors and companies. At which point I say what? I mean, this was the whole point of why the founders and framers of this country put such strong regulations on corporations, on the ability of corporations to own other corporations. In most states up until Reconstruction, up until the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, in most states it was illegal for a corporation to own another corporation. It was illegal for a corporation to do more than one thing. It was illegal for a corporation to have a monopoly. And when those laws started getting knocked down in the states as a result of John Rockefeller in the 1880s, the 1870s and 1880s being attacked by Ohio for illegal activity with his Standard Oil Trust of Ohio, and he said, okay, what states will change their laws so what I'm doing will be legal in their states? And New Jersey and Connecticut and New York and ultimately Delaware has the least restrictive. They all said, we will. And the charter mongering era of the 1880s, all these states did away with these laws that control corporations. So Senator Sherman from Ohio introduced in December of 1881 the Sherman Antitrust Act, Senate Bill number 1. to say, okay, if the states aren't going to do it, we will at the federal level. And the Sherman Antitrust Act, Reagan essentially stopped enforcing it in the early 1980s. And as a consequence of that, what you have is exactly what, and I hesitate to use his name, but it's exactly what Karl Marx predicted. You will end up with just a small handful of very, 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 very powerful corporations controlling entire industries. There is no more competition. There is no more free market. It is an oligarchy. And ultimately, the result of that is that you have no more democracy, because they control the power. 16 minutes past the hour.
Now there's people living out in the streets, going hungry with no shoes on their feet. While the government just twiddles its thumbs and spends more money on guns. And they keep on planning nuclear war. Tell me, who is it they're planning it for? If not the men that beat their profits. I swear it seems they can't wait. This is what democracy means. This is what democracy means.
And welcome back to the radio home of democracy. 21 minutes past the hour. Mr. Cox said the consolidation in the accounting industry had prompted... Now, you would think consolidation in the accounting industry would cause Congress to say, hey, wait a minute, there's only four major companies? They control virtually everything. There's only four. We have to break that up. That's not good for America. It's not good for investors. It's not good for the business community. It's just not a healthy thing. No. This is what it says in the New York Times. Mr. Cox said the consolidation in the accounting industry had prompted both Congress and the commission to consider ways to prevent the demise of another firm. See, we can't have another Arthur Anderson. We can't have one of these big accounting, one of the, used to be the big five, right? We can't have one of the accounting firms go down in flames because they commit fraud. So let's just change the fraud laws. Let's just change the level, the threshold at which we enforce this stuff. This is nuts. The Sherman Antitrust Act passed in 1881. I think it was 1882 it was actually passed, but submitted. Every contract, combination in the form of trust or otherwise in conspiracy or conspiracy in restraint of trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations, is declared to be illegal. Every person who shall make any contract or engage in any combination or conspiracy hereby declared to be illegal shall be deemed guilty of a felony. And on conviction thereof shall be punished by a fine not exceeding $10 million if a corporation or if any other person $350,000 or by imprisonment not exceeding 3 years or by both said punishments in the discretion of the court. That's trusts. Now monopolizing. Every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize or combine or conspire with another person or persons to monopolize any part of a trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations shall be deemed guilty of a felony, and on conviction thereof shall be punished by a fine not to exceed $10 million if a corporation or if any other person $350,000. This is back in the day when $10 million was a hell of a lot of money. Or by imprisonment not exceeding 3 years or by both said punishments in the discretion of the court. And then it goes on. It even talks about, you know, if you're conspiring with regard to trade with foreign nations. So the answer from the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Bush Securities and Exchange Commission, let's just make it easier for corporations to engage in this kind of behavior without being prosecuted, or really it's the reverse. Let's make it harder for investors to sue. Again, quoting from the New York Times, the SEC brief in the case Telabs Inc. versus Maycor Issues and Rights Limited said that the appeals court set too low a threshold and that the law required investors to show by evidence a high likelihood that the defendant possessed the intent to violate the law. Professor Fish of the University of Pennsylvania School of Law, he said the SEC basically is now, he said it reads like a litigant brief. He says, after reading the brief, one has to wonder if the SEC is now on the side of the defense bar. In other words, has the SEC become a lawyer, a law firm, for these big four accounting companies. Now, at the same time, the gap between what Americans import and what they export widened to another record in 2006, totaling $763.6 billion. That's how much money we spent that other people didn't spend in the United States. So they end up with that money. So what are they going to do? They're going to come back here and they're going to buy our ports. They're going to buy our companies. They're going to buy our roads. They're going to turn them into toll roads. They're going to buy our water supplies. They're going to buy our power supplies. They're going to buy our land. They're going to buy our mountains. They're going to buy our minerals. They're going to buy our water. They're going to buy everything. $763 billion we went in debt just on trade. This is not the congressional debt. This is the trade deficit. As Jeremy Peters writes in the New York Times, it was the fifth year in a row that the trade deficit broke through its previous record, which in 2005 stood at $716.7 billion. Now, keep in mind, 40% of all that trade is within individual companies. In other words, you have a company, you know, Walmart in China making something and selling it to Walmart in the United States. Frankly, I don't know if it's Walmart, you know, if Walmart has, probably they're the exception to the rule, actually. But you have companies that are selling products in the United States. You know, Tupperware. They'd say, well, this is Tupperware. We're selling it in the United States. So they set up a factory in China. It's a Tupperware factory. So it's within the company. Another demonstration of what happens when companies get so huge. And again, I don't know if Tupperware is the very best example of this, but they're all over the place. All of these very, very large corporations want this so-called global free trade. This is all about the corporate takeover of not just America, but the world. You know, now we're going to join Canada, the United States, and Mexico into they're talking about the entire world. As George Bush Sr. said, it's a new world order. And so we as a nation go deeper in debt, which means we're going to have to sell off more of our natural resources and more of our businesses in order to keep buying junk from overseas, and a lot of it is, frankly. And what's that doing? It's wiping out the middle class. Because when we're buying stuff from overseas, we're not buying stuff made here, which means our jobs have gone overseas, too. 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for national health care. Welcome back to our program. Our number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click the live chat link. The significance of all this is just there are so many different symptoms of the same problem happening right now. And I suspect that the vast majority of Americans have no idea that we're looking at the same problem from different points of view, or not different points of view, different symptoms of the same problem. And the problem is the deregulation of American industry by Ronald Reagan and those who followed. He took a big chunk out of it. And then Bush Sr. took another chunk out of it, and then Bill Clinton took another chunk out of it, and now George is, hey, throw the doors open. You see, when the Republican Great Depression happened in 1929, Americans got it. If we allow corporations, particularly large corporations and a small number of very, very wealthy oligarchs, very wealthy families, to basically rule this country, we are going to be back like we were in the era from 1830 to 1860 and from 1880 to 1901. We're going to be back in an era where every 5 or 10 years we're experiencing the equivalent of a depression. We have right now over 40 million people living in poverty in the United States, 45 million people with no health insurance. That's more people than were living in poverty during the Great Depression, numerically. There were only 100 million people in the United States at the time. But, I mean, that's massive. And so what Franklin Roosevelt did during the Depression is he looked at that and he said, you know, capitalism is a fine thing and I'm all in favor of it, but within limits. We have to allow, we want businesses to start. We want, as Teddy Roosevelt said, he was a big fan of small and medium-sized businesses. He says, but when you get to large businesses, you got to watch out. Teddy Roosevelt talked about the danger of trusts and monopolies. Franklin Roosevelt talked about the danger of trusts and monopolies. He put Joe Kennedy in charge. He was the first commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Gloria Swanson was a friend of mine years ago. She was on the board of directors of the Community for Abused Kids that we had started up in New Hampshire, and she had been a lifelong vegetarian, and it was part of our diet. And I used to get together with her a couple times a year in New York in her apartment. We'd make dinner together and just talk. And she told me the story, and it's not unique to her. I've heard it, you know, since then in other places. It's probably apocryphal. That Roosevelt put Joe Kennedy in charge of the SEC because it takes a crook to catch a crook. She certainly thought Joe Kennedy was a crook. He took terrible advantage of her, and she was very, very bitter about it. But in any case, what happens is when you have a small number of very wealthy and powerful corporations and people controlling your economy, then the economy doesn't run in a way that's best for all Americans. And when we are importing $763 billion more than we're exporting, we imported $2.2 trillion worth of stuff last year, and we only sold $1.4 trillion worth of stuff to the rest of the world. When you do that, what you end up with is a situation where all these companies, all these foreign companies and individuals are sitting on all this cash because we bought stuff from them, and then where can they spend it? In the United States, it's dollars. And so you get things like AirTouch Communications being bought by Vodafone in the UK for $60 billion, and Amoco being bought by British Petroleum for $48 billion, and Chrysler being bought by Daimler in Germany for $40 billion, and Deutsche Telekom buying VoiceStream Wireless for $29 billion, and Atlantic Richfield being bought by BP Amoco for $27 billion, and Best Foods being bought by Unilever in the UK for $25 billion, and HSBC Holdings, one of the big credit card companies and financial service institutions, being bought by Household International being bought by HSBC Holdings in the United Kingdom for $15 billion. And on it goes. Lucian Technologies, it was one of the spinoffs when Jimmy Carter was enforcing the Sherman Act. He busted up AT&T. Their research division became Lucian Technologies. They were bought by France for $13 billion. They used to be based in New Jersey. Pacific Core, one of the big suppliers of electricity out here on the West Coast. They're owned by the Scottish company, Scottish Power PLC. They bought it for $12.5 billion. The Swiss group, USBAG, bought Payne Weber for $12.2 billion. And that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. The total, since Reagan started his policy of not enforcing the Sherman Act, and we started getting these insane trade deficits, the selling off of the American middle class, the selling off of American industry to huge multinational interests, we have seen a total of $1,750,846,777,202 worth of American businesses bought by foreign-based corporations or individuals. That's almost 14,000 companies. And on average, $167 million a day comes into the United States in what's referred to as direct foreign investment, which people like Tom Friedman think is a wonderful thing, where foreigners buy us. And you're no longer working for the man who lives down the street. You're now working for the man who lives in Tokyo. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with Tokyo. We should be having trade with Tokyo. But wouldn't it be nice when your labor and mine produces a profit, which is what businesses do if they're well run, when your labor and mine produces a profit, that profit stays in the United States, is taxed in the United States, goes to stockholders and investors in the United States, so it gets spent in the United States, so it creates another profit, so it stimulates the whole economic cycle and keeps things going. I mean, isn't this just basically common sense? Now, here's where it gets even larger. CNN just reporting right now, the former third-ranking official at the CIA, Kyle Dusty Fago. Remember Dusty Fago? Good buddies with Duke Cunningham. Number three guy at the CIA. He's going to be indicted in San Diego Tuesday in an ongoing investigation into public corruption and defense contracts, according to two sources familiar with the case. Well, this then ties back to, and again, this gets us back to the whole issue of corporate power and what's going on in this country. This gets back to the fact that you've got some federal prosecutors in those few areas where we are standing up, where we as a nation are daring to stand up to the rich and powerful in this country, and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, if you're not acting in the interest of the nation, stop. We have federal prosecutors, or we had, six federal prosecutors, six federal attorneys, one of whom prosecuted Duke Cunningham, which led to this, perhaps directly, at the very least indirectly, what looks like going to be an indictment of Kyle Dusty Fago at the CIA. One of these guys was the guy who made this happen. Actually, it wasn't a guy. It was a woman, Carol Lamb, U.S. attorney in California. Bush goes in and says, okay, you guys, you're toast. We don't want any more federal attorneys who are investigating Republicans. How dare you? In fact, it was announced, Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty says six of these guys were fired for performance-related issues. But five of them, including Carol Lamb, had just received a letter of recommendation. She said, Lamb was described in her 2005 evaluation as well-respected by law enforcement officials, judges, and her staff. Overall, the review was positive. We're not aware of any significant issues, said another Justice Department official. But she's not toeing the line. And the line is this conservative line of, it's not what's best for the people. It's not what's best for the middle class. It's not what's best for working America. It's not what's best for democracy. It's not what's best for freedom. It's what's best for multinational power, multinational corporations, and very, very mind-bogglingly wealthy families like the Walton heirs. And it's wrong. And I would argue that indirectly this even led to the war in Iraq. John in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Love your show. I've called you numerous times, and I call you my teacher.
Well, thank you.
Hey, Tom, my question for you. Well, I got two things. One, I got two issues. The first issue that really bothers me is that the media makes a big deal about Anna Nicole, which, yeah, it's sad. But you know what? They don't talk about all the soldiers that died that day, you know?
Yep.
My second question to you is there any way the president could be court-martialed?
No. He's not a member of the military. Actually, under the Military Commissions Act, he could declare himself an enemy combatant and appear before a military tribunal. But that's the only way it could happen. So, no, he could not be court-martialed.
Because he can
be impeached, however. The Constitution provides two remedies for dealing with a chief executive, with a CEO, with a president, the head of the executive branch, with a president who has run amok. The 25th Amendment says if he's incapacitated, then he can be removed. And the Constitution itself says that if he commits high crimes and misdemeanors against the United States, he can be impeached.
Tom, are the Dems working on this? I mean, you know,
I think they are. There are 52 investigations into this administration right now where hearings are being held by Democrats in Congress. They're not getting a lot of press. This is not, a lot of it is not sexy stuff, and most of it is stuff that the big corporate media doesn't want to talk about, frankly, because some of it may end up looking at them as well. But there are 52 investigations going on right now, and any one of those may find impeachable crimes, offenses by the Bush administration. And I guarantee you, well, I can't guarantee you, but I believe that when they do, that's what will happen. 45 minutes past the hour.
Have a nice day.
And welcome back to Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. The European Commission, the EU's executive body. I just want to wrap this up. In fact, in the next hour, I want to talk to you about Bank of America. Another piece of this in today's Wall Street Journal. Bank of America is now offering credit cards aimed at people who are in the United States illegally, which is a whole brand new interesting thing. But back to the EU. The European Commission, the European Union is poised to drop a punitive tariff on imports of frozen strawberries from China, a signal it won't always bow to pressure from groups seeking protection from the Asian giant. Now, this is sort of a double negative in here. There's this battle been going on between Poland and China about frozen strawberries. And the Polish producers are saying, hey, you know, we're growing strawberries here in Poland, but we want to be able to pay the Polish workers, the people who are growing these strawberries. You know, we don't have, you know, a country next door that we can draw cheap labor from. And so we're picking these strawberries ourselves, and we'd like to pay ourselves a decent wage. And so our strawberries are costing, you know, a buck a pound or whatever it is. But in China, they're growing the strawberries with slave labor. And so even when you figure in the cost of shipping them here, the Chinese strawberries, in, you know, being sold in the European Union, are only 50 cents a pound. Now everybody in Europe says, hey, that's cool. 50 cents a pound strawberries, we like that. But it's putting a whole industry in Poland out of business. Does this sound familiar? We used to make clothing in the United States. We used to make shoes in the United States. We used to make televisions in the United States. We used to make computers in the United States. We used to make fill in the blank in the United States. I mean, I was always amazed. My dad worked in a tool and die shop most of his life, and I would hang out there when I was a little kid. And they'd be making these real fine pieces of very, very super hard steel to, you know, to make dies that would be like extrusion dies and things for plastic. And so they'd be like forming the thing that they would inject the plastic into, for example, to make, well, I remember bicycle parts. I remember toys. I mean, it was always some cool new thing that the guys were working on back in the shop. These were, by the way, union tool and die makers who made a good union salary. Well, that business is pretty much wiped out, the tool and die making industry in the United States. Because there's no companies in the United States who are making those toys anymore or those bicycles anymore. And the other big customer they had was General Motors. They were making a lot of stuff for Oldsmobile. There's an Oldsmobile factory literally four blocks away. And even Oldsmobile is taking a whack. You could argue that that has to do with they're not necessarily making the biggest car, you know, the smaller cars that people want. And you know, maybe they didn't anticipate the market or something like that. But yeah, that's a whole other issue. But here we have the EU had decided to protect one of their own. The Polish said, hey, you know, we've got the strawberry industry. Let's protect it. Let's put up a tariff. Because there's no way Polish labor can compete with Chinese slave labor. Well, now the European Commission, the EU's executive body, is going to take these tariffs down. We're talking about $300 million a year worth of business. That's big money in Poland. It's nothing for China, but it's big money. Well, to quote John Miller in today's Wall Street Journal, Europe's trade stance towards China is a matter of big business. Trade between China and the U.S. surged recently, rising to $260 billion in 2005 from just $112 billion in 2001. That increase has fueled a protectionist outcry throughout the European Union. And member states are demanding more trade barriers to protect Europe's blue-collar workers from Chinese competition. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that Tom Friedman's world is flat view benefits the very, very wealthy, the large multinational corporations, and any country that is willing to enslave its people. So you have communist capitalism in China outdoing democratic capitalism in Poland. He notes in the Wall Street Journal today, behind the change are the growing complaints of European lawmakers that rely on less expensive raw materials and basic products from Asia. French retailer Inter IKEA System BV said it has been told a possible complaint by European furniture makers would likely be rejected by the Office of the EU Trade Commissioner. That Swedish company gets 18% of its products from China. But they're complaining about this. I mean, they want to make sure that they can still make stuff in Sweden. What are they going to do? Well, what they're going to do is blow away local companies. Kurt in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Kurt, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. We could get rid of these Bush tax cuts for the rich and basically get the propaganda going and repeal the Reagan middle class tax increases of the 1980s. First of all, we need to make it so we're not, we're going to make exempt unemployment checks from income taxes.
Yeah, it's crazy to pay taxes on unemployment income. Agreed.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I agree with you. It's crazy that you pay income tax on unemployment or, for that matter, Social Security.
Okay, and then we need to make tips exempt from income taxes that bartenders and waiters make. And also, we need to make exempt the interest you make from a savings account.
Sure.
And I just think...
That would encourage savings. You know what this? You know what the average savings rate right now in China is? Kurt, are you familiar? It's 40%. The average Chinese person, the average Chinese is setting aside 40% of their income in savings. In the United States last year, it was -1%. Last year in the United States, people took 1% of their savings out and spent it. Our savings rate is negative in this country. And you wonder why, you know, why are we having a difficult... And in part, that's because our good jobs are gone. People are just hanging on by their teeth because 26 years of Reaganomics is destroying this country. We need to reverse it. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you with, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman radio program. 6 minutes past the hour. We were talking in the last hour about the economic consequences of these insane conservative economic policies. Now we're seeing it broadened out with the Bank of America. And this is where, and feel free, by the way, to take me on with this, because I know that this is going to, you know, that some of our listeners are going to disagree with me on this. And it's a great conversation, frankly, I think, for all of us to have. That now where this is going, and see, again, I see this as part of the one entire piece of fabric, the conservative war on the middle class in America. Now where this is going is where the Bank of America, which I may be wrong, but I don't think is an American-owned company anymore. I should have Googled it before we got to it. Anyhow, the Bank of America has now decided that they're going to start offering credit cards, not just offering credit cards to people who are in the United States illegally. They're going to market credit cards to people who are in the United States illegally, specifically Hispanics. This article in today's Wall Street Journal by Miriam Jordan and Valerie Bauerlein. In the latest sign of the U.S. banking industry's aggressive pursuit of the Hispanic market, Bank of America Corp. has quietly begun offering credit cards to customers without social security numbers, typically illegal immigrants. The Bank of America program, the new Bank of America program, is open to people who lack both a social security number and a credit history. So, you here illegally, you have no social security number, you have no credit history. No problem. We'll give you a credit card. As the Wall Street Journal notes, most adults in the U.S. who don't have a Social Security number are undocumented immigrants. The Charlotte, North Carolina banking giant tested the program last year at 5 branches in Los Angeles and last week expanded it to 51 branches in Los Angeles County, home to the largest concentration of illegal immigrants in the United States. The bank hopes to roll out the program nationally later this year. Now, let me just be on the record as saying I am not opposed to human beings getting in need getting services. There are a lot of areas where I separate myself from the cons on the whole issue of illegal immigration. You've got the you know, Republicans like Lou Dobbs out there saying, oh, you know, we need to build a fence and we need to, you know, get buses and haul them off. And how dare a church feed people who are hungry? And, you know, I'm not there. I'm sorry. Building fences is a joke. It's not going to work, first of all. 40% of the people who are in this country illegally came in on tourist visas and just kept, you know, just stayed here when their visa expired. You build a fence, what's going to happen? The number of people coming through the normal, you know, speaking specifically of Hispanics, although it's true of, you know, anybody anywhere, but that's where all the attention is paid right now, in part because of all the nascent racism in the Republican Party. It's really easy to get Republicans whipped up by talking about people who have, you know, have dark skin. But also in part because Hispanics, particularly from Mexico, constitute the largest portion of illegal immigrants in the United States. And so, you know, there's that reality. But the fact of the matter is that if you build an absolutely impenetrable fence, let's say that we duplicate the fence that used to separate East Germany from West Germany. You got barbed wire that's 15, 20 feet tall, you know, chain link with topped with barbed wire, 15, 20 feet tall, with a 25, 30 foot wide path in the middle of it that's got sand that is periodically, every other day or so, groomed so that a single footprint will show up on it, that has motion detectors in it. Every 200 feet, you've got a tower that goes up 300 feet in the air, and you got guys with machine guns and binoculars up there and telescopes. You put you build it so that the edge of the fence is still 10 feet inside your own land. So the next 10 feet out from the fence, on the other side, on the Mexican side, this is how the East Germans did it. 10 feet on the west, on the East German side, on the West German side, if you were standing in West Germany, if you walked up to 10 feet away from the fence, you would think, hey, I'm still on West German property, right? The West Germans had to go through and they had to put up all these, you know, caution, Grenze, border signs, and landmine signs, because what they did was that last 10 feet, which was East German property, they put landmines in it. So we put landmines on the Mexican side, and then you put a 20-foot high fence with barbed wire, razor wire across the top. Then you put a 30-foot wide sand, you know, thing, and then you put another barbed wire fence, and then you put guard towers with guys with machine guns. You do all that, just like East and West Germany did. What's going to happen? You're going to have twice as many people coming through the port of Tijuana, through, you know, I mean, you've got millions of cars and trucks, right? This corridor opening up, free trade, after all, is wonderful. You're going to have twice as many people getting tourist visas. I'm going to visit my uncle who's working in Colorado. And they'll just, you know, they'll come here on a 6-month tourist visa and just stay. Come on, the whole idea of a fence is a joke. It's a great project for Halliburton. Bechtel is salivating. The defense contractors, they want to build virtual fences. It is a nice buzz phrase for the Republicans, but it's crazy. But the issue of immigration ultimately gets down to the supply of labor. This is all, once again, it gets us back to big corporations and what's best for them. My point is there are no illegal, it's not to say that there's no illegal immigrants in the United States. It's that it's not an issue of illegal immigrants. It's not about the people. It's about the employers. It's about the corporations. And about the other corporations who are enabling this, who are making it possible for the people who are working for the illegal employers to get credit cards. I mean, this is pretty amazing. It's very profitable. The credit cards involved aren't cheap. They come with high interest rate and upfront fee. Bank of America defends the program, saying it complies with U.S. banking and anti-terrorism laws. Company executives say the initiative isn't about politics, but rather about meeting the needs of an untapped group of potential customers. See, that's the bottom line. From a corporate point of view, it's not about America. Screw America from the corporate point of view. I mean, that's their worldview. There's profits to be made. What this is all about is diluting the American workforce and how anybody can say, oh, well, there's jobs Americans won't do, at the same time that we have ghettos in the United States. It's nuts. It's just plain old flat out nuts. But David Ricardo pointed out in 1814 with his Iron Law of Wages and his treatise on labor that if you increase the labor supply, you will drive down the cost of labor. If you have more people looking for jobs than there are jobs, the employers don't have to pay as much. It's real simple. It's why the railroads were importing Asians in the 1880s. And again, you know, the anti-immigration laws back then had a big racist component to them, just like, you know, there's a lot of racism in the anti-immigration sentiment right now. And we need to acknowledge that. We need to face that. That's an ugly side of America. But at its core, the reason why the progressive movement in the United States fought against immigrants being brought into this country specifically as laborers for the railroads in the 1880s was not racist. It was about wanting jobs. It was about wanting to maintain a middle class. The reason why throughout history, I mean, throughout the history of the United States, the progressive movement has always said, we want to control, we want to reduce the supply of labor. The reason why Cesar Chavez and Walter Mondale marched from California's Central Valley down to the Mexican border in protest of illegal immigration was because illegal immigrants were diluting the labor force and making it harder for the union, for the United Farm Workers Union to organize. And as long as you've got millions of people in the country who are willing to work for virtually anything because it's better than what they got at home, then you've got two problems. One, your own middle class is going away, and two, where they came from, there's no more social pressure to improve it. We provided a giant release valve for Vicente Fox and his right-wing buddies, who just happened to get, you know, elected in the last election. Gee, what a surprise. Well, because anybody who really would have the entrepreneurial nature, the spirit, the willingness to take risks, to stand up and fight back, they channeled that energy into crossing the border and getting into America and finding a job. You know, and that's I understand that. It's a noble thing, you know, to say, hey, I'm going to do the best thing for my family. And yet at the same time, countries need to say, this is the labor force that we have relative to the work that needs to be done. And certainly in the United States, as our jobs are being exported, our manufacturing jobs are being exported, and now our labor force is being imported, and Bank of America is saying, great, we'll help make it happen, I have a problem with this. 16 minutes past the hour.
What you do or not what you say, you're not part of the future, then get out of the way. Come on, baby, take a ride with me.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Eric in New York City. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you again. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your great work. And there's so much I'd like to talk to you about. I have one comment about the SEC thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as credit cards for illegals, I would tell your listeners there was another issue early about home loans for illegals.
Yeah, and the Wall Street Journal broke that, too, and we reported
right.
it on this program. That was about a year and a half, 2 years ago.
We have to watch Bank of America very, very closely because, first of all, it's disgraceful. It's disgraceful to Latinos in America. I'm a Latino. I'm a Democrat. I'm strictly anti-illegal. It's embarrassing. The problem is, are these even secured cards? I mean, when these thieves default on their loans, is it going to be left to the American taxpayer to pay for it?
Well, no. Bank of America is large enough that they'd have to eat it. And that's why
they're going to have to be, because I mean, this is not going to go. They want to be so quiet about it because I think this is illegal. Can I now, as an American citizen, can I just pretend I'm illegal and apply for a credit card without a social security number and say,
apparently,
oh, I'm illegal? You know.
Apparently, if you walk into a Bank of America and you have an account with them and you speak Spanish and you walk in as if you're...
I don't think I have to have an account.
No, but let me finish the sentence here. This is from the Wall Street Journal piece. If you go in and you speak Spanish in a Bank of America, there are Spanish-speaking employees who will come up to you and they will say, and this is a quote, she suggests in Spanish, quote, maybe you have family or friends who don't have a Social Security number but wish to build their credit.
It's disgraceful. This is just part of it's corporate America offsetting their costs.
Yep.
The American taxpayer shafting them, and just it's just part of.
You have to make a $99 down payment, a security payment that they hold in escrow for 6 months, and you have a $500 line of credit. These are relatively small credit cards, but it's a beginning. It's a way to start building credit.
How much goes to us? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. How much of the bill goes to us? It's disgraceful.
You know, all of the bill for the destruction of our labor force is what's going to us. That's my problem, Eric,
problem exactly too, because that's who ends up getting the shaft, the American citizens.
Yep.
You know, my other real
And the Mexican citizens are getting the shaft too, by the way, because people who have
That's another whole big saying, I know, Tom, you're always saying the problem is illegal employers, not illegal employees, which I probably disagree with. I mean, in a way, that's almost the chicken and the egg, because, I mean, we've had the problem of illegal immigrants since before NAFTA and GATT. So it's like,
after Reagan's amnesty in 86,
exactly,
when he said, okay, on, we're going to officially wink and turn the other way and not look, you know.
I have one more quick question about the SEC, like investors not being able to sue their companies. I don't know, maybe it's a positive. Besides some shaman Freuda, you call it, for some people who deserve it.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe one positive will be that people who are oblivious to this, if fascist ship is this pure unadulterated fascism.
Right.
Maybe
control
the few
of the
people who
by corporations.
Right. Few people who do own stocks in America will start to see. Hey, wait a second. You know what's going on here? Hello.
Yeah. And perhaps.
You know, I don't know. I don't know what you make of that. Maybe that's something that'll come out of it.
Time will tell, Eric.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call. And thanks for pointing it out. I appreciate it. Tomas in Grand Rapids. Hey, Tomas.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm great. What's up? We only have a minute or so. We got to take a break here.
Okay, I'm
building
a fence, and I think that if we funnel people through legal ports of entry, then we can authenticate and validate where they're going, you know.
Yeah, but you've got 40% of the people who are in this country right now illegally did not cross the desert in Arizona. They came through a port like a Tijuana with a visitor visa. If you build a super impenetrable fence, that 40% is going to become 80, 90, 100%. You're still going
to
have people coming here.
Well, then we need to restructure that visa program.
No, if you throw some employers in prison who have hired people who are not citizens, then people will stop staying here because they won't be able to pay the rent.
I don't know. I think those people that are living in the state that they are in Mexico will come over anyway because they have
not if they can't get a job.
They can start their own business, man.
No.
They can sell apples. They can, you know.
No.
They can mow lawns.
It takes
12 to a room.
Yeah, well,
anyway,
you know.
Wouldn't it be nice if the senators in the Senate started filibustering for their middle class?
Yeah, it would be, Tomas. It absolutely would be. You know, the mowing lawns and living 12 to the room, that's like starting out. But once you reach the point where, okay, I've got enough money that I'm going to try and get a real job, you can't get a real job, so why even start with the mowing lawn? Steve in Atlanta. Hey, Steve, we got about a half a minute. What's up?
You got a problem with illegal immigration? You can blame one person. It's all the executive branch. The job of enforcing that falls squarely under the administration.
That's right.
I got 2 points real quick. I'll get them in as fast as I can. I saw an article that the INS is waiting outside of jails for the immigrants to come out that have been arrested and then deporting them. So basically they're contracting their work out to our local law enforcement.
Jeez.
You saw it, see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then also you get the conflict of the construction company say, look, let me clear cut this land, develop, make subdivisions, because look at all the jobs it brings. But then you turn the other page, you see the construction people saying, we need immigrants to do these jobs.
Yeah, yeah. And they don't, in fact. It used to be that being a carpenter, getting a card in the Carpenters Union, was a ticket to the middle class in the United States. I suppose in some areas it still is, but increasingly you drive by construction sites and those are not union workers. They're not even U.S. citizens. And it's a crime against the middle class of America. That's the bottom line. And a crime against the middle class of Mexico as well. 27 minutes past the hour.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your life. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up.
And welcome back to the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America. I understand that around 2000, the largest unions in the United States decided to embrace illegal immigrants. I think it was, frankly, a crass move to increase union membership. And I understand it. I'm not criticizing them for it per se, you know, on some kind of horrible moral basis. The unions in the United States are facing literally survival. There has been a 26-year war. When Ronald Reagan came into office, one quarter of the American workforce, 25% of all Americans, held a good union job, were members of a union. which meant that more than 50% of all jobs were the equivalent of a good union job, where you had a pension and you had full health care and you had job security and, you know, all the things that go with a union job. Now, that was down from the peak of 35% in 1947 when the Republicans took Congress and passed the Taft-Hartley law that allowed states to opt out of the 1935 Wagner Act and become so-called right-to-work states, non-union states. So, that was the beginning of the Republican assault on organized labor. But when Reagan came in, it was down to 25%. No, we don't, Alex. Drop it. When Reagan came in, it was down to 25%. And it's now gone. I mean, you know, we're down to now like 7%. 7% of the American workforce. Is in the private workforce, is unionized. And the public workforce, those people who are employees of the federal government, the Bush administration is trying to whack that as this is what the privatization is all about. And so, you know, I understand that the Democratic Party has been sucking up to folks who are in this country illegally, and the unions have been because it's a survival issue. The Democratic Party has been because they need the votes. The Republican Party has been from day one, or not from day one, from 1986 when Reagan pushed through his amnesty. And now we have, you know, unorthodox initiatives like the new credit card program may be crucial to Bank of America's long-term success. This is from today's Wall Street Journal. In the past, the bank, which operates in 31 states in the District of Columbia, grew mostly by buying up other banks. Now, however, it is bumping up against a regulatory cap that bars any U.S. bank from an acquisition that would give it more than 10% of the nation's total bank deposits. That means Bank of America's only way to grow domestically is to sell more products to existing customers and attract new ones. They've built as many branches as they can build. So let's go for the illegals. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Norma in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Norma. Norma? No, Norma. Okay, we'll put. Norma's there. Okay, hello, Norma.
Hello.
Hi. You are on the air. Norma. Okay, we'll come back to Norma. Steve in Mountain View, California. You're live and on the air.
Oh yeah. Hi, Tom. So you were talking about the gradual destruction of the middle class and the loss of jobs. In Silicon Valley, it's been quite insidious. You may remember Carly Fiorina, the HP.
Oh, yeah, the president of HP, the woman who was the president of HP.
I can't say her last name, probably right. Fiorina. Anyway, who came back from Lucent, by the way. What's been happening here in Silicon Valley is that highly skilled, knowledgeable people who built Silicon Valley have been, you know, slowly and but consistently being pushed aside in favor of imported people who work for about 16% of the same, you know,
the
wage.
HB1 visas.
Yeah, and every year the local Silicon Valley corporations scream for more and more F1 visas because they claim that they can't find enough skilled people here in this country.
Yeah, and the skilled people are certainly here. I was, you know, it's interesting. I was in India. It must have been 85. I don't know. I have a hard time, you know, keeping track of what years were what. And actually, it must have been the early 90s when Microsoft was holding a jobs fair down south. I wasn't actually there for it. It was just in all the newspapers. I flew into Bombay and took a plane to Hyderabad and then took a long train ride all over to the West Coast into the kind of little town that nobody had ever heard of. They were hiring engineers at $10,000 a year and, you know, master's degree, and it was just like this big deal. And all these jobs, you know, these thousands and thousands of jobs. Now, that was for a center that they were setting up in India. But and my recollection may be wrong on the exact amount, but it was in that neighborhood of pay. But I remember I used to own an ad agency in Atlanta, and we sold that when we moved to Vermont 15 years ago. And I needed to hire a guy who was a graphic artist who spoke and could write and proofread Japanese, Spanish, and English. And I thought, this is impossible, right?
Wow.
I'm going to have to hire three people to do this. I ran an ad in the Atlanta paper, And there was a fellow, his name was Shinji, Shin was his name, his first name, who came and applied for the job, and he was ethnically Japanese. His parents both spoke Japanese at home. He was born in Peru because his father was working in Peru on behalf of a Japanese company. And when he was 18 or 19, he was about 23 at the time, when he was 18 or 19, he came to the United States. So he spoke, and in Peru he also learned fluent English in school. So he was fluent in English, Spanish, and Japanese. And he was a graphic designer. In fact, he was a graduate of a graphic design school. And he had just completed the previous year. He didn't have a work permit. He didn't want to go back to Peru. And here I am applying, you know, looking for somebody to do exactly what he could do. And I had to go to the INS with this guy. We went through a process that took at least 3 months to get him a visa so that he could work for us, because I genuinely couldn't find an American who spoke Japanese, Spanish, and English, and could proofread in all three languages, and was a graphic artist. And, I mean, this is just like the coincidence of all time. But this was back in the 1980s. This was 1988. And when at some level, our immigration laws were being enforced. And it has completely changed now. I'm convinced now all I'd have to do is just write a form letter saying, you know, I can't find anybody who'll do this job, so I want to hire this guy, you know, from you know, fill in the blank, from Peru or from the Ireland or whatever.
Yeah.
And boom. Okay. Approved. And it's just wrong. It's countries. And there's a reason why if you go down to Mexico and you think, oh, I'm going to retire to Mexico, and you go down there and you try and get a job, they will throw your butt in jail if you're working illegally or deport you. There's a reason why if you go to, you say, hey, Ireland's really cool, or, you know, Norway, where my grandfather came from, my father's family, you know, I go to Norway and say, hey, great social system, you know, high pay, the most literate country in the world. I'd love to live in Norway. They won't let me live there. When I lived in Germany, it took me 4 months, maybe even 6 months, to get a work permit to work in Germany for one year.
Yeah, I travel all over the world. I'm not xenophobic. It's just that it's hypocritical to say that you have to go look to the other end of the earth for someone who has the right skills when we've got huge numbers of people here in Silicon Valley who are just ridiculously high skilled.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's really, they're just dodging the economic issue.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's all about corporate profits. Steve, thank you for the call. Russell in Patch Junction, sure. Arizona. Hey, Russell.
How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, there was a couple things I wanted to bring up. And the one that I thought of is not the one I told I was going to talk about. It's the corruption factor.
Yeah.
When you have, you know, I've heard that example's not the best way to teach. It's the only way. And when you have a government, state, federal, local governments, ignore laws, and selectively enforce the ones they want. I don't know about you, but I feel like a contempt for our government. And like I've been writing to the Democratic Party about Iran, and let's get a resolution forbidding any, you know, overstep there.
Right.
It's like they don't hear anything we say. Nothing.
I know. And that's why more of us need to be speaking out. I mean, it's just that, you know, during the Robert Barron era, it took a lot of people, you know, Joe Hill getting murdered in Salt Lake City, and you know, the whole Wobblies and the progressive movement and the populist movement and the Grange movement and all these things led to Teddy Roosevelt in 1901, who had been elected as a, you know, rich white business guy who was going to look after the interests of the Robert Barons. It led to him looking around going, hey, wait a minute. You know, it's not the robber barons that I'm hearing from right now. It's the people.
At least they produced real well for the country back then. These people are paper pushers today.
Yeah. Well, there's that, too. Kevin Phillips' last book is brilliant on that topic. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and one other thing. I agree 100% about the employers. It's not a big mystery here. All this dance. And Lou Dobbs is not completely racist. A lot of what he says is okay.
No, I know. Frankly, I don't think that Lou Dobbs is at all racist, but I think that a number of the people who end up on his program are, you know, that's their song and dance.
He sees the middle class disappearing. And you know, and he says the Mexicans and even the people in this country who are here, and we're not going to deport people, but by God, we ought to start throwing employers in jail right now.
Yeah, amen.
And take care of the people and legalize the people who are here, and let's get it over with. You know?
There you go. Well said. Thank you, Russell. Appreciate it. Kim in San Francisco. We have about a minute before we have to take a break. Kim, what's up?
My husband is an engineer for a major, major communications company. And he planned the fiber optic cables that went to where the cheap labor was all the way back to the late 80s, early 90s. And if people think that this outsourcing is going to slow down or that we're going to top it, they're sadly mistaken, because you can look at all these different major cities in India, they are laying fiber optic cable right now as we speak.
Sure,
that,
but it's,
and,
still,
and you know
it's still possible to tax services from outside the United States, Kim. It's just not being done.
Well, okay, I hate to say it, but I'm pessimistic. I want this to happen. This has got to stop.
Yeah, I agree. Spot on. You're singing my song. And you know, just like you have tariffs for imported foreign goods, we can have tariffs for imported foreign services. If you have a call center in India, that's fine. You're paying them $3 an hour, that's fine. But the prevailing wage in the United States is $12 an hour, so for every hour you pay them, you're paying $7 tax. Where do you want to work them now? 45 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 9.5 minutes before the hour in the Darwinian world of ideas. We're at the top of the food chain here, and sitting atop the food chain is Victoria Jones, star of radio, television, and the New York Times. Victoria.
Well, no, I'm not mentioned by name because that's not the protocol, but my question is in the front page story on Iran today. Yes, it is. It's very nice to be in there.
In the
New York Times.
Ah, okay. You were also this morning on Sam Cedar's program, which precedes mine on Air America Radio, on some affiliates. Alex, you just played the clip for Victoria? Oh, Sam, yeah, Sam Cedar played the clip of your question.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's great. Tell us what the question was and what happened.
Well, the question was, and I don't have the exact words, but it seemed like an obvious question to me when we were talking about Iran supplying these weapons, very nasty weapons they are, and Iran does nasty things, to Iraq to blow us up.
Mm-hmm.
And 170 Americans apparently have been blown up. So my question was, what direct evidence do you have that senior levels of Iran's government have been involved in getting these weapons over the border into Iraq? I phrased it slightly better than that, but that was the gist of the question. What direct evidence do you have?
And this was a question that you asked of whom?
Of Tony Snow at yesterday's White House press briefing.
And his answer was...
Well, it was a bit too jumpy all around the world, really, for me to be able to detail it to you here. It would take the rest of your show.
Really?
It was fairly lengthy.
He did a song and dance, in other words.
He did a song and dance. I think at some point I was referred to Embassy Baghdad. I did do follow-ups. He said, you know, that the link was there and that, you know, that nothing much happened in Iran without the senior parts of the government being aware of it, and so you could link them. So I basically said, so you're saying you can it's deduction? That you're deducing this?
Mm-hmm.
That there is, in fact, no direct evidence?
Are we starting to get deja vu?
Well, all over again.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. So, well, good on you for that. I mean, but did you ever, he never actually did give you a straight answer, did he?
Well, no.
Okay.
You're expecting straight answers. I mean, my goodness.
Good. Yeah. Who would? But I mean, you know, in the past, the Bush has given us, you know, straight comments. I mean, he's, you know, for example. Here we go.
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
So he says that, and then he goes on about the weapons of mass destruction.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
And he goes, I mean, I've got a whole collection of these clips, but the point is that in the past, they were pretty unabashed about just coming out, and what we're now finding is lying to us. This information being pulled together by Doug Feith in the Pentagon with the CIA saying, no, that's not what we said. No, that's not what we said. No, we didn't say that either. And handing it off to Cheney, and Cheney hands it off to Bush, and Bush goes out and says it. Now it sounds like they're getting a little more careful.
I think they are getting a little more careful. And in fact, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Peter Pace, was extremely careful, in fact, yesterday when he went so far as to say that they didn't have the evidence that Iran was doing this. And so the situation we had today in the White House press briefing room was an interchange between one of the reporters and Tony that caused Tony to basically accuse the reporter of getting overexcited, because Tony was completely unable to answer the question as to the difference between the statements.
How is it that the front page of the New York Times, USA Today, I mean, all these newspapers, they're all quoting, well, CNN, for example, in the first 8 paragraphs of their story on this day before yesterday, or yesterday, I guess it was, the first 8 paragraphs, 6 of the first 8 paragraphs started with a phrase that was a variation on, as military officials say, officials in the military say, according to the U.S. military, no attribution. Who the spokesperson is. I understand that the cameras had to be turned off. People had to leave behind their cell phones because they might be able to take pictures or record information. The person who was giving the briefing was not, you couldn't tell who it was. Were you in that briefing, by the way?
I was only in the White House briefing.
I see. Okay. So the people who went into this briefing and what came out was all this stuff about the military says this, and then Pace, who is the military, I mean, he's about as far up as you can get. He comes out and he says to Congress, no, it's not. He didn't contradict it, but what he said contradicted it. How can that be? How can that be? How can it be that the New York Times is presenting this stuff like gospel and then gets contradicted the next day by the military itself?
It's almost incomprehensible. What we're being told by Tony Snow is that everybody is, in fact, on the same page. Now, that was frankly incomprehensible to every single person in the press corps except Les Consulting today.
Yeah, good old Les. Okay, so, all right, we have about a half a minute before we have to wrap the hour up here. We're talking with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. What's going on in Washington, D.C. beyond that?
The Iraq resolution is being debated in the House, 435 of them. They get 5 minutes each. It'll take about 3 days. We expect something like between 20 and 60. At the moment, that could change. Republicans to cross over and vote with the Democrats, condemning the escalation of troops.
So this thing is going to pass, but it has absolutely no effect.
Has no effect. It'll pass, and it has a historic effect.
Yeah, although it's the equivalent of saying, declaring a National Arbor Day or something. Well, actually, Arbor Day would be even more. It's more like saying, the official state flower is the gardenia.
I think you're about right there.
Even that would probably have more power, because then they have to put the flower on the letterhead or something. Okay, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for asking the tough questions there, Tony Snow. Good on you. I congratulate you. You're wonderful. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be back. Is Jeb Bush waiting in the wings? You might be surprised.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, you want to get truly frightened? Probably not. But alarmed, concerned, wake up and pay some attention. Jeb Bush is going to be running for president at some point in the future, and probably in 4 years, or 5 to 6 years, technically, in all probability. And the guy who has done arguably the very, very best job of documenting Jeb Bush's tenure as governor of Florida, Jeb had to leave because of term limits, is S.V. Date. In fact, over at his website, S.V. Date, D-A-T-E.com, spelled like S.V. Date. It's always Date. SVDate.com. Here's this quote from the Tallahassee Democrat. Date is one of the best reporters in Florida, which means that if Bush made a descending list of his favorite Floridians, Date would rank below those of some whose death warrants he's signed. Kirkus Reviews, Bush 2008. Anyone who worries at the prospect will want to have a look at this partial and revealing portrait. S.V. Date, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Glad to have you on with us. This book horrified me. Well, I mean, you know, from the gravel flying out of the back of trucks to the woman who was in charge of releasing public documents to Jeb coming up with the funny ways to talk about both Social Security and the inheritance tax. I mean, it's just there's no end. It's like every page is another horror.
Well, yeah, some people will see it that way. I guess that's the best way to look at it. If you like what this president has done, you're going to love Jeb because he's going to be much more efficient at it and much more competent at seeing it done.
Yeah, because he's clearly a very, very smart man.
Oh, absolutely. And he doesn't rest. All right, he's relentless, and he will not stop until either term limits force him out of office or until he's accomplished what he wants. So if you don't like what the current president is doing, then you ought to be very afraid of this man, frankly.
Now, the goal of the Bush dynasty, of the Bush, of George Sr. and Barbara, was that Jeb would be the second president of the United States to have the Bush name, don't you think?
Well, I think that's true. Carl
Rove put a kibosh to that.
Well, you know, Jeb's overreach in Florida, I think, put an end to that. I mean, had he won as well in 1994, I think there would have been a very interesting little rivalry as to who was going to run in 2000. But, you know, before that, remember that Barbara Bush actually thought that three of her children were going to be governors in three different states. You know, Silverado Savings and Loan put an end to Neil Bush, but he was actually considered to be the most personable, the most engaging, the best natural politician.
Wow. So give us an overview. We're talking with S.V. Date. His new book is called Jeb, America's Next Bush. If I fail to give you the title, I'm sorry. This is a book that you should read. And just give us some broad, you know, pretend I haven't read the book. What's this about?
Jeb Bush is now at 54 years old, which means that he's been running for president for the last 46 years. I think that's the best way to put it. He has been thinking about the White House since he was a child, and unlike most people who, you know, that comes in the same category as, oh, I'm going to be an astronaut, I'm going to be a fireman, I'm going to be a president. For him, this was a real possibility. You know, his grandfather was Prescott Bush, who was a senator who thought that he might have been president had he run earlier in his life. His dad, at the time, was on his way to working in the Nixon White House and had run himself for the United States Senate from Texas when he was age 40. Jeb knew from a very young age what he was about, and in 1994 he ran for governor. He lost, but only barely, and only because he was going up against probably one of the most popular guys in Florida history, Lawton Childs. He won 4 years later, but it's kind of this quirk of fate for the planet, really, because that same year, 1994, that Jeb lost, his brother won in Texas in a race that no one thought he would.
Right.
So he had the inside track for the Republican nomination.
Well, he also had his brother had Karl Rove with him, and I
that's
understand
true.
That, you know, Karl had an awful lot to do with.
Oh, absolutely, Karl Rove's a very smart guy, but you know what? I don't think Jeb needs a Karl Rove because Jeb is
the Karl Rove.
Yeah, he understands this. He's a good tactician, a strategist that I've seen in Florida, and that includes his successor, who's a very interesting character himself. But,
Mr. Charlie Crist.
Right. Interestingly, Charlie Crist is much more popular than even Jeb was right now. And the reason is Charlie Crist has taken the party back toward a much more moderate direction. He likes to think of himself as a Teddy Roosevelt.
Is that all
Republican
for show?
I think it's the real deal. I mean, he went after the insurance companies, and he made them, you know, they did
so
not
So Jeb must be really upset, because this is completely inconsistent with Jeb's worldview. I mean, Jeb is like, all you know, the big corporations should rule the country.
It's 180 degrees opposite of what Jeb had done with the insurance crisis here in Florida. It was funny because, you know, I wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post recently, which just got hammered because people thought I was defending Jeb. And what I did was say, compared to his brother, he's more competent and, you know, we'll pay more attention, et cetera. And I just got destroyed with the amount of email and comments saying, how could you do that? I took all of these things and compiled them and sent them to Governor Bush and said, look, Governor, I know you're having a rough couple of weeks seeing what's been happening in Tallahassee. here, these will make you feel better. You know? And this was right at the time. He was up in D.C. talking to some conservative group and getting standing ovation just for being there. And he wrote back, I really have been following the news out of Tallahassee. And I just had to laugh to myself. I mean, you know, this guy, man, follows the news everywhere all the time. And for him to pretend like he's not been watching what's going on here was, you know, a little bit silly.
We're talking with SV Dante. He covered Governor Jeb Bush for 8 years as the Tallahassee bureau chief of the Palm Beach Post. Probably knows him better than any of the journalists in America, lives in Tallahassee, and is the author of the book, Jeb, America's Next Bush. Give us, we just have 2-3 minutes left here, SV. Give us a quick overview of Jeb's worldview and how America would be if he were president, and how you expect him to run for president.
Well, let's take the last one first. How do we expect him to run? You know, everyone talks about Bush fatigue and how this is going to just turn off the voters, et cetera. Let me ask you, how many people thought in 1997, right, that the next Republican nominee was going to be the son of the guy who was turned out of office 5 years earlier?
Yeah, nobody.
You know, nobody. Jeb will do this because in order to win the Republican primary, you got to win the Republican base. He owns the Republican base. So the 30% of the people in this country who still think that the president is doing a good job, they vote in Republican primaries, and they're going to vote for Jeb.
Yeah, that's the 90% of the Republican base.
Right? And once you've got the nomination, now it's a 50-50 shot. Now, at that point, you know, who knows what's going to happen in 2 years. He may wait until 2012 with Charlie Crist. I'm not sure that he can safely do that. He may need to try to go for the VP slot right next. But, you know, it's a wonder what $200 million in TV advertising will do for your brand name and for your image. And he will raise that without breaking a sweat. He is good.
You think he might run for vice president in 2006? In 2008?
Oh, you know, 7 years ago I would have laughed at the idea that Jeb being vice anything, because he just doesn't have the personality for it. He needs to be in charge. I mean, he's very good at that. He likes that. Mm-hmm. But now that may be the most reliable
way to get in, especially if it was somebody who was a senior statesman like John McCain,
who may not run for a second term. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But his risk is, you know, if you don't do that, who's going to remember you necessarily in 10 years you've been out of office? So he's got to think about that. I'm sure he is. He's making good money on the speech circuit right now. But
or might he run for the United States Senate?
No, that's utterly ridiculous. I mean, it's funny because when we used to ask him back in 05, 06, are you going to run for president? He would always say, I am not running for president.
Right,
okay, present tense.
Right.
Ask him, are you going to run for Senate? And remember when Catherine Harris, that whole debacle was going, are you going to run for U.S. Senate? I will not run for the U.S. Senate. And that's true. I mean, to imagine him as 1 in 100 is ridiculous. That's absurd. It's not going to happen.
Very precise in his use of language.
Yeah.
One of the things that Jeb Bush was very, very good at was shutting down the flow of information in Florida.
He decided that, in fact, the chapter I named it, you know, Who Wants to Know.
Yeah.
If it did not fit his storyline on how things he saw the world and he was going to shape the planet according to his worldview, if it did not work along those lines, he was going to stonewall and not release it and put up new barriers. And Florida, remember, had some of the best open government laws and public records laws in the country.
Had.
Well, I'll tell you what. Charlie Crist, when he came in, the very first thing he did was sign an executive order creating an Office of Open Government, try to get back to that. So that must have made Jeb Bush a little bit angry, I guess.
Well, is Jeb going to take his papers like his brother did, his gubernatorial papers, and stash them in his father's library so
well,
no one can see them?
Well, he can't. Under Florida law, all those things are public, and believe me, we're getting them. So,
okay. Well, keep up the good work. SV Dante is his name. The website, SVDATE, SVDate.com. For the book is Jeb, America's Next Bush, His Florida Years and What They Mean for the Nation. SV, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Viagra for your brain.
I'm in the trucker. A mother loving, overloaded owner operator just tearing up the two lane road. Yeah.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Indeed, Bush. You know, there was a post over at Common Dreams by a psychology professor out east someplace who said basically the core of the whole thing was that Bush is delusional, that a delusional person just doesn't understand, doesn't get, doesn't see reality. And over in Huffington Post now, Melinda Henneberger posting this piece about Bush saying that you know, just everything's just fine. He says, I was just chuckling because I think, you know, somebody asked him, made a reference to Goldwater Republicans and Rockefeller Republicans, and he chuckled, his word, and stopped the questioner from finishing his thought. He says, I'm just chuckling because I think Goldwater Republicans and Rockefeller Republicans are pretty far past. That's rude of me to chuckle, but I'd be cautious about stereotyping philosophies. And then they say, you know, what are you going to be remembered for? Oh, I'll be remembered for my compassionate conservatism. And there's all this noise about Iran. All these people are worried about Iran, but I think it's just politics. It's just politics, don't you know?
I do think it makes sense to make it clear to the Iranians through the international community that they're isolating themselves, and we'll continue to press hard to do so. This feels just, I guess my reaction to all the noise about, you know, he wants to go to war is, first of all, I don't understand the tactics, and I guess I would say it's political.
You don't understand the tactics about why we say that you want to go to war? Well, because you're positioning three carrier groups in the Gulf. Because you're positioning soldiers, because you're moving submarines into the area, because you're positioning soldiers in the area, because you already have Gulf states notifying you that you can't use their bases for military operations, because you got Russia freaking out, because you got the entire military going, that this is it. We're in for something serious here. You've got leaks coming out of your administration going that he's already decided to go to war. We heard this before, Mr. Bush. And then continuing this about this conversation, certainly his own position on Iraq could not be described as having evolved at all. He said, if we fail, this is Bush, if we fail, it's more likely they'll come here and want to kill Americans. Right. That guy in Iraq who's planning the roadside bomb right now, who 5 years ago was working as a car painter in a car shop, or who was a clerk in a clothing store, or who was a teacher in a local school, or who was an electrician installing, you know, outlets in people's houses. That guy who's planting the roadside bombs because his country is occupied and he doesn't like it. If we leave, he's going to get on a plane and come here and take us out? Come on. And we need to go after Iran. I mean, if China had attacked the United States, if China looked at the United States and said, you know, that United States, they have weapons of mass destruction. They do. They really do. It's a massive stockpile. It's huge. It's absolutely huge.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
So Fu Hintao was to say that of us, which is true, and that our elected leader actually wasn't legally elected, as the New York Times reported on September 12, 2002, when they actually counted the ballots in Florida, and they were to say, we're going to free you from an unelected dictator who is taking away your rights and your liberties, who is setting up torture chambers, who is deporting people to other countries, who is kidnapping people. We're going to free you from this guy. And they started bombing us. And then the Chinese troops showed up. I suspect you and I would not feel all that freed, even though we didn't like George W. Bush all that much or what he was doing. And we might even show up out in the streets with an IED or two. And then, you know, if any of us went to some of our friends in Canada or in Mexico and said, help us throw out these Chinese occupiers. We really don't want them here. And so let's say we cross over the border into Canada or into Mexico and we buy some ammunition and we use it against the Chinese troops. And now China says, oh, look at this. We have proof they have weapons made in Canada. Now we need to invade Canada as well. I mean, just think about it. This is the worldview that the average Iraqi has right now. The last Zogby poll in Iraq, more than 80% of Iraqis say that it's okay to shoot at Americans. Not just they want us out. It's okay to shoot at us. And so Bush is going to move three carrier groups into the Gulf. He's fixing for another war. I'm frankly very concerned about this. And we need to be speaking to our lawmakers and saying, you know, we can stop this war before it begins. More people do not have to die. 866-440-8466, our number, 27 minutes past the hour. Nobody dying, nobody worried. Must be Sweden. The place where reason and passion go together like Republican presidents and gay hookers. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. And some of the oddest things going on out there. Yes. A 66-year-old German tourist, annoyed by stringent security at Manila's airport, dropped his pants before walking through an X-ray machine, newspapers said Monday. Authorities were not amused, tragically. Instead of boarding a flight to Frankfurt on Friday, Hans-Jürgen Oskar von Nagaszewski was detained after police filed a complaint of lasciviousness against him, the Philippine Daily Inquirer and the Philippine Star newspapers reported. Airport Security Chief Angelo Atitubo was quoted as saying he must have been annoyed that he was asked to walk through the X-ray machine twice, so he took off his pants. He spent the weekend in police detention and could face 6 years in jail. The police sergeant said he really didn't say much, unlike Filipino passengers who would talk a lot. He was clearly irked, and he showed it by disrobing. Yeah. Well, now you know what not to do when you're going through the airport in Manila. I've been through that airport a few times, but that was back before they had X-ray machines. And, of course, there are times when you think that you know what's going on, and there are times when you think that you don't, and there are times when everything you know.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe the next time the boss finds you snoozing at your desk, take heart, writes Rob Stein in the Washington Post today. A new large study has found that people who regularly took a siesta are less likely to die of heart disease. Dimitrios Trikopoulos of the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston, who led the study that was published yesterday in the Archives of Internal Medicine, says taking a nap could turn out to be an important weapon in the fight against coronary mortality. They studied 23,000 people in Greece, and they found that those people who took a nap in the middle of the afternoon were a third less likely to die of heart disease. So, you know, if in the next few hours you feel a yawn coming on, give in. It might be Michael Twerry, who works with, directs the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute's National Center on Sleep Disorders Research. He says, napping may help with the stress of daily living. Yeah, it may. I want to get into the, the lighter side of the news there for the moment. But I want to get into something that looks like almost cause and effect. Yesterday afternoon. It is not cause and effect, by the way. Yesterday afternoon, CommonDreams.org published, and a number of other websites, OpEdNews.org and others, it was first published over CommonDreams.org, an article that I wrote called Repeal the Military Commissions Act and Restore the Most American Human Right. And it's basically about our loss of habeas corpus. This happened in September of last year. It was passed by Congress, the Military Commissions Act. And it was signed by the president in October of last year. We were told at the time that it only repealed habeas corpus for aliens, that is for non-citizens, inside or outside the United States. But in fact, when you go through and you read the law, you find that there are several places in the law where it doesn't refer to aliens. It refers to persons, which is you and me. Habeas corpus is Latin for hold the body or produce the body. And it basically means that you have to charge a person with a crime and give them due process or let them go free. And not only did the U.S. Military Commissions Act do away with the right of habeas corpus, but it also includes a court-stripping provision. In other words, you can't challenge it in the courts. And basically, you have no option to appeal a thing. And you can't even appeal to the, you know, to international bodies, to the United Nations, the Geneva Conventions. None of that stuff is available to you any longer. Because the Military Commissions Act basically says, no access. None of it. So as a result of this, now, Alberto Gonzalez was testifying before Congress, before Arlen Specter, last week. And this was perhaps the most mind-boggling piece of testimony that I have ever heard in my entire life. He said, now, first of all, before I tell you what he said, let me just read you. This is Article 1 of the Constitution is the part that deals with the legislative branch of government, right? Who can make the laws? Because the framers of the Constitution believed that the Congress, because it was directly elected by the people, was closest to the people, and so Congress should be the first article in the Constitution. The second article was the president, who's indirectly elected through the Electoral College. The third article was the Supreme Court, because it's the third branch of government, and it's not directly responsive to the people. I mean, they talked about this in the Federalist Papers. There was a method to their madness. Congress is the first among equals. And Section 9, Clause 2 of Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution says, and I quote, "The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus," which is a fancy way of saying your right to being charged with a crime, to face your accuser, to have your day in court, to have a trial by a jury of your peers, to be able to make bail. I mean, that's the core of habeas corpus, right? The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. So Alberto Gonzalez goes before Arlen Specter and he says, and I quote, "There is no express grant of habeas in the Constitution. There is only a prohibition against taking it away." Now, first of all, the Military Commissions Act takes it away, and there has been no invasion. I mean, I suppose they're arguing that 9/11 was an invasion. It wasn't. It was an attack, but it wasn't an invasion. I mean, the last time we had an invasion was the War of 1812, when the British and the Canadians actually invaded and actually took possession of the White House and burned it. And did President James Madison say in 1812, as the White House was on fire, we've been invaded, let's suspend habeas corpus? No. Did he say, let's do away with the Fourth Amendment rights of protection of privacy? No. Did he do away with the Fifth Amendment's protection rights of habeas corpus? It's right there in the Fifth Amendment. You know, basically, no person shall be deprived of life or liberty without due process of law. You can't be arrested, you can't be executed, without having it go through a court. No, he didn't suspend the Fifth Amendment. Did he suspend the Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments to say that you have the right of a trial by jury and to make bail and do a speedy trial? No. Because he believed in American democracy. He believed in this republic. When Gonzalez says there is no express grant of habeas in the Constitution, there's only a prohibition against taking it away, what he's saying is that in his mind, and this is what's so scary, Yeah, I talked about this a little bit last week, but this so deserves repeating. What is so scary, what he is saying is that in his mind and in his boss's mind, George W. Bush, the rights that you and I have are given to us by the government. That's how they think. That's what they believe. That's what Gonzalez was saying. And he was quite explicit about it. He had back and forth with our own inspector about this. That if it's not in the Constitution, you don't have that right. And Scalia, by the way, on with the issue of gay marriage, essentially said the same thing. You'll find another piece I wrote about this about 3 years ago when Scalia first said this at a law school in Vermont when I lived there. And right down the street from me, he comes to town and he says, there's no right to gay marriage in the Constitution. These guys actually think that you and I get our rights from our government. The first three words of the Constitution are, we the people. We are the holders of all rights. If you go back and you read Federalist, I think it's Federalist 84, I may be wrong, but it's in the Federalist Papers. Alexander Hamilton went on this long rant about why there should not be a Bill of Rights attached to the Constitution. Why? Because he said the Constitution itself is a Bill of Rights. That all rights are derived from we the people, the first three words of the Constitution. And that if we attach the Bill of Rights to the Constitution, future generations may mistakenly believe that the Constitution grants rights. And here we are. The Constitution only limits the power of government. We did it. The first three words of the Constitution, we the people of the United States of America, we do ordain and establish this Constitution. In order to, you know, go through the whole preamble for all these reasons. We're the ones who hold the rights. And so just because the Constitution doesn't say you have the right of habeas corpus, instead it says you can't take it away unless you have an insurrection or a rebellion, just because it doesn't say you have the right doesn't mean that we don't have the right, Mr. Gonzalez and Mr. Bush. But they needed a law to explicitly take it away from us, and they did. And now Senator Chris Dodd says, okay, let's restore the Constitution. More about that right after this. 45 minutes past the hour.
May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true. May you always know the truth and see the light surrounding you. May you always courageous, stand upright and be strong, and may you stay. Forever young.
Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the USA. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. This is an ad that a fellow by the name of Chensen put together. It's on YouTube. I mean, it's amazing the stuff you find on the web, right? I'll just let it stand for itself. I'll let it speak for itself. It's 30 seconds.
In my country, a group of religious extremists are reshaping the government to promote their own agenda and morality.
The government can keep a list of everyone I call, and they do not need a judge's permission.
Our citizens are seized and held in prison without being charged of a crime. Without the right to a trial and without a lawyer. Why should you care about what is happening to my country? Because my country is the United States of America.
There you go. So Chris Dodd is putting forward this Restore the Constitution Act of 2007. He says, today I plan on reintroducing the Restoring the Constitution Act of 2007. The bill will restore habeas corpus protections to detainees, bar information acquired through torture from being introduced as evidence in trials, and limit presidential authority to interpret the meaning and application of the Geneva Conventions. Good on you. Restore-habeas.org is the website. And just a marvelous thing. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Max in La Jolla, California. Hey, Max, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. I appreciate you were talking earlier about habeas corpus and the losing of that. And I have a comment that I don't mean to sound cute at all, but you were talking about rebellion and I think You were talking about invasion and invasion.
The Constitution actually talks about the only time that habeas corpus may be suspended in the United States. There were two presidents who asked for permission from Congress to suspend habeas corpus, Abraham Lincoln in 1863 and Ulysses S. Grant in, as I recall, 1872. And it was because South Carolina was threatening to secede from the Union during Reconstruction. In both cases, you had insurrections and rebellions, you know.
Yes.
But
Tom, the Constitution is no longer relevant. The Constitution no longer is at all runs this country. We have been taken over. There has been a rebellion. There has been an invasion. It's really very, very clear. The 30-second ad you just played illustrates that beautifully. You know, it's kind of like talking about what used to be before 1963. We could have talked about the Constitution with some, relevance, but, it no longer is relevant. I mean, we should really get with the program and recognize the country has been taken over. It has been invaded. The Constitution no longer applies. It's only us dreamers out here who can only talk about it on the radio but can't do anything.
Max, I could make a very good case, and I think you would probably agree with me, that the Supreme Court handing Bush the election in 2000 when he actually didn't win the majority of the votes in Florida, and that has been documented now by a consortium of newspapers who actually counted the vote, that the Supreme Court handing him that, when three members of the court who voted to hand him that had family members who were working on the Bush campaign and were in direct conflict of interest, was a coup. That this country suffered a coup in the year 2000, and we are still suffering the consequences of that coup. I'll give you that.
As was Blackwell in Ohio.
Yes. Yeah. The same, 4 years later, again, another election based on fraud. But there was an actual coup d'etat in 2000. I think that you could build a strong case for that. And I still think it's possible to take it back. And if Chris Dodd can get this law passed, this Restoring the Constitution Act of 2007, I still think that we can take this country back. I think that the DNA is in our, democracy is in our DNA. It's in our genes. We have had that. We have had democracy, or at least the ideal of democracy in this country for over 200 years. We're not like Germany that had only had democracy for a dozen or so years before Hitler took it apart.
Yeah, so I agree with you completely that freedom is in the genes of all human beings, not just Americans.
Yes.
And that eventually that will certainly happen. I just think it's healthy psychologically to recognize where one is at before one tries to go forward from there. And talking in the context of that the Constitution is still something even to be considered is ridiculous, because nobody with any power is considering it at all, except with regards to conversational placation of the masses.
Well, to a certain extent, it seems that you're right, Max, and we keep all hoping and praying that Congress is going to stand up and assume their constitutional, not just rights and duties, but responsibility, and do something about this presidency
that is clearly
run amok. Well, I'm not sure that they're not going to, and I really think that if enough of us raise holy hell, that they will. And I think that's one of the reasons that Chris Dodd is out here, putting forward his Restoring the Constitution Act of 2007.
There are some of us left, like Chris Dodd and yourself and myself and many, many others, who are true patriots, meaning that they don't worship this government, they don't worship policies, they don't even worship this country. What they worship is the principles that generated this country. That's true patriotism. And yes, there are those of us who will stand up like Chris. On the other hand, there are the other fellows who have taken this thing over so beautifully and efficiently. I don't mean beautifully like I approve of it, but beautifully like efficiently, starting from 1913 when they put in the Fed Reserve, in 1963 when they took the head off of the guy who was going to make it right, and so forth and so on. These guys are very organized and very intergenerationally efficient, and these guys plan.
And dynastic. I mean, this goes all the way back to Prescott Bush and before. Max, good point. Thank you very much. I am not convinced that the Federal Reserve is at the core of all of our problems, but I'll certainly, go back and read Smedley Butler's War as a Racket, or his, what happened to him in the 30s when they approached him to overthrow Roosevelt. I mean, this is not the first time that there's been talk on the right about taking down the government of the United States. Coming up on tomorrow's program, the top news of the day, plus conservative Dan Gaynor and I are having a healthcare face-off. What's better, Schwarzenegger's plan or Bush's? Are these the only choices? Yeah, and Jonathan Moreno here with us for an Everything You Know Is Wrong segment as well. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.